This podcast is suitable for professional clients in the UK and UAE, and for accredited and institutional investors in Singapore.
I'm Danny Knight, Head of Investment Proposition, and joining me today is Marcus Brooks, our Chief Investment Officer. Looking at the third quarter, it was a tough period for financial markets. We saw a huge sway of asset classes posting declines across the world. Really, investors grew increasingly concerned about a recession thanks to a combination of hawkish central banks, major disruptions in energy supply chains, and also turmoil in late September, which really focused in the UK on the back of our mini budget. Today, we will focus on three core themes, which should help you discuss market backdrops with your clients. Inflation as the root cause of the macro backdrop, how bonds are back after a decade of being in the doldrums, and really finishing on a more positive step, have markets already priced in a lot of bad news? As usual, you'll be able to receive a CPD certificate following today's event, confirming your attendance. Marcus, good morning. I made the point that a lot of what we've seen in markets year to date really has centered around inflation and central banks trying to push that inflation level down. We've seen the UK reach an all-time high recently. What is your view, and do you think that's really the main driving force impacting markets year to date?
Yeah, I think undoubtedly inflation has been the biggest worry for financial markets year to date. You've got the worst returns in the bond market since 1931, at the same time as the worst returns in equity markets since 2008. So it makes it stand out as a particularly bad year for all asset classes. If you're like us, where we run multi-asset portfolios, you'd expect the diversification benefits of having relatively safe bonds with equities, which would give you the growth, to be a really good way of giving good, strong risk-adjusted returns. But this year, because of inflation, I must say it is inflation, bonds do not react well to inflation. But also, the growth rate has also been moderating. Now, if we focus more specifically on inflation, what causes it? Well, there's kind of two elements to it, demand pull and cost push. So the demand pull element of inflation, well, that was really the easing of COVID. We'd all been locked up. We suddenly wanted to go on holiday, buy cars, change the carpets, whatever it was. The pent-up demand to do things meant that we wanted to buy things, but they weren't all necessarily in the right places. Because of furloughs, because factories are shut down, there was too much money clamoring for too few goods, which pushed the price of those up, a bit like an auction does. And then on the cost push side, well, the events over in Ukraine, we've seen the Russians invade Ukraine in their special operation. That has led to hydrocarbon prices going up extraordinarily high with the oil price and natural gas. Now, these are things that don't get substituted well. You can't just refuse to use oil and natural gas because that is what heats our homes and drives so many other bits of our industry. So it's inflation that people haven't been able to escape. The demand pull component seems to be easing. The world is opening up. Things are moving easier. Even the cost of freight moving around the world, that's now coming down. So I think that's good evidence that part of inflation is moderating. The cost push bit, I still think, has got something to work through. And indeed, in the UK, you know, we got record high levels of inflation, the likes of which we haven't seen for decades. But actually, the forecast is that it probably peaks in November 2022, not this month. So there's possibly a little bit to go through and then possibly a little bit of moderation into 2023.
And that's the UK, so potentially further behind maybe the US and other G7 economies. There's rhetoric that maybe we've really seen the peak from a G7 perspective.
Yeah, so when we look at the US economy, the economy there is red hot. I mean, it's got super low unemployment levels. Growth is still very good, whereas in the UK it's moderating somewhat. And the Federal Reserve has been that much more aggressive in raising rates, you know, 75 basis point rises, which the Bank of England has been reticent to do because they've seen a picture of softness in the UK economy. Why raise too harshly into a decline in growth when actually just end up cutting rates more sooner? So in the States, they're a slightly stronger environment. Therefore, they need stronger monetary policy to tighten that down. So it could be that we've already seen the peak of inflation in the States. It's not necessary that we have seen the peak in interest rates in America. They could go to, say, circa 5% around about May next year's sort of forecast. So a little way to go yet, but that seems to be the right pathway. Growth in the US for next year is forecast to be around about 1%, so it'll be a moderation of growth this year. But that's what they're trying to do. That's the point of raising interest rates.
You touched on growth there, and there's a growing rhetoric around are we entering recessionary territory? Are we in a recession? Will it be shallow and brief? Will it be harsh and last a lot longer? I think this really is all premised on the rate hikes and where we are with inflation. Is growth a concern for you? I look at recent data. Developed markets definitely look like their headline figures are set to slow, but there may be some positive shoots. The emerging market data looks stronger from a growth perspective.
Yeah, so the cost of living crisis isn't a uniquely UK experience. It's happening around the world, and it's happening for all the same reasons. High inflation, higher interest rates, real disposable income going down because everything's costing more. So where we're seeing growth around the world, everywhere seems to be slowing to some degree. I think the shock for a lot of people is that China, which is the world's factory, most of the stuff that we consume is made in China, because they've had an extended COVID lockdown, actually growth there is looking very, very slow. And actually, people are now speculating that a new paradigm of growth in this world's second largest economy may only ever be 3% or so. But they've got some credit issues over there as well. So there are some unique Chinese factors that means that global growth as a whole could be slower. But actually, when you look around the world, I don't think there's a tremendously bright spot that you can point to, given that everyone is trying to deal with the same consequences of higher inflation.
We saw the Bank of England had to really step in as almost the buyer of last resort on the back of the mini budget we saw in the UK. Bonds broadly have given up the last decade of returns. We've seen fixed income really have a tough time. Equally overnight, everybody was using the acronym LDI. Maybe can you spend a moment just to explain what does LDI mean and how did that impact markets and why did the Bank of England have to step in?
Sure. So LDI stands for liability-driven investments. It's a corner of the investment world that most people don't ever really shine a light on. It tends to relate to defined benefit schemes, not DC. DC is where people put in their own money and they end up with an amount, a pool that is the pool. With a defined benefit, as it sounds, the employer puts in some money to the pension fund and they guarantee that there's going to be an income at some point related to your final salary. That's why they're known as final salary schemes. Now, in a DC scheme, which is what the majority of people have got these days, they're relatively cheap to manage because the liability is on the individual. They're not affected by this at all. You just pay in your money and that's it. In a DB scheme, defined benefit scheme, the employer doesn't know when people are going to retire. They don't know what salary those people are going to be on. So they make actuarial forecasts of the amount of money that they need to save to meet those pensions in the future. Now, what they've come up with is a terribly mathematical way of doing it called liability-driven investing. In other words, they work out the sort of cash flows. If you know that you've got a bunch of 40-year-olds and a bunch of 50-year-olds and a bunch of 60-year-olds, you can forecast when they would retire. You can work out how much of your workforce is going to retire when, the sort of salary they might be on, and therefore put money aside. But you know you don't need it all today. You need it over years to come. So what they do is they put a certain amount of money aside in the form of very high quality bonds, typically government bonds, importantly. And if they're a really big scheme, they don't need to use a liability driven fund. Quite a few smaller employers choose to do that so they can pull it together. It brings down the costs. However, what it appears is that they are not fully funded. So they enter into derivative contracts with investment banks to try and cover that gap. Now, what it means is if the value of that derivative goes down in any way, or rather the pool of assets which are going to meet all the liabilities, then actually they've got a post-collateral to the derivative. That's what happens with derivatives. It's all a bit complex. But the point is these liability-driven funds can only redeem money and get it 3 days later, whereas the collateral that needs to be posted is today. Now, the value of bonds goes down as interest rates go up because they're fixed income. So if you think about what's been going on, the value of bonds has been going down because interest rates are going up. Therefore, the collateral value has gone down. Therefore, they've had to sell some bonds to make the collateral okay. But in selling the bonds, no one wants to buy them. The price goes down further. So they've got less assets again. They have to sell more bonds to meet the collateral. It ends up being a death spiral until those bonds stop falling in price, which is why the Bank of England stepped in and bought bonds. Suddenly there was a buyer of these bonds that the pension funds were being forced to sell. That put a floor underneath them. That meant the pension funds were no longer moving towards default, which would have been a nightmare for so many future pensioners. It's one of those unintended consequences that monetary policy can have. If people lose confidence in your ability to pay your debts, in this case, the government paying the interest on bonds because they're being reckless from a fiscal point of view, then actually the price of those bonds goes down. to reflect a higher interest rate environment to cover. It's a bit like if you've got really bad credit as a private individual, you don't get to borrow at 2 like the government does, you get to borrow at 22. So that's kind of what that happened. It just caused a real disturbance in the bond market.
And that market confidence is key. A third of UK government issuance is bought from international investors, so really important. Maybe linking to that point, it's probably the first time I've seen some multi-asset managers being excited about the opportunity with fixed income. It's been in an environment where I've seen most managers not particularly excited. Is it now a good opportunity, or is there an opportunity within fixed income for multi-asset portfolios, both to exploit an opportunity, which we potentially could see in the shorter term, but actually fixed income behaving like that true diversifier, which it has historically within a portfolio. Now you're getting a reasonable level of yield, and there's some protection characteristics given we've seen that increase in yield.
Yeah. So if you think about the dynamics of a bond, it pays you a fixed amount of money every year until that bond matures. So what are the drivers of the return of a bond? Well, A, can the person who owes you the money, will they be around in right at the end to pay all your money? And B, is the amount of money, the fixed income you're getting from that bond, good or bad relative to inflation? Now, where we find ourselves today is there was a worry in the UK bond market that the UK government didn't know what it was doing. Then you look at inflation. Well, as we discussed earlier, inflation probably hasn't peaked in the UK. It may elsewhere, but it hasn't peaked in the UK. But at some point it will, and it might be November. Now, if that's the case, if inflation starts coming down, that's when bonds do really well. So if your forecast is that the world is in a slowing place, that inflation does come down, that actually the creditworthiness of whatever it is you're trying to lend to, UK government, US government, is going to get better because they realise they've got to get a proper tax policy. Tax for the government is income. It's a bit like our wages. The money goes into the government. The higher the taxation, the more their ability to pay goes up, then actually bonds are offering a decent yield at this moment in time. If, though, however, you think growth is about to take off and inflation stays high, I think you've got to be a lot more cautious about bonds. But it's fair to say the super low yields that we've seen for the last decade or two are probably behind us now.
Maybe trying to move on to a slightly more positive outlook. I definitely think there's some opportunity, in particular for active management. I think super low interest rates for the last decade have suppressed some of the opportunity, and we know passive strategies have done hugely well. Do you think markets have priced in a huge amount of bad news? It could be worse, and we obviously are in the quarter three earnings season in the US, and people are going to look very closely at that. But I think some of that bad news is already priced in. Where are you from a positive outlook perspective?
Yeah, so if we try and do the thought experiment, what would it take for you to be positive? I think there's some very good indicators out there. If you think about what a bad bear market looks like, take 2008, for instance, the all share was down around about 35, 40%, something of that order. Same with the S&P 500. Emerging markets were down an awful lot more, 60, 70, 80%, depending on which you were on. Now, when you look across the developed market space, the S&P 500 is down over 20%. The NASDAQ is down over 30%. If you look at the DAX, the German index, over 20%, Hong Kong, over 20%. So there's lots of areas where you're at least halfway through, in price terms or total return terms, a pretty nasty bear market. Now, is it right that we should be expecting a nasty bear market given the forecasts that we've made, that inflation will moderate, growth will moderate, maybe the UK goes into recession, maybe the US just about escapes it? Well, that's not really nasty bear market type of 2008, where Lehman's was going bust and Northern Rock was going bust and there was financial distress everywhere. It doesn't feel like that environment. It feels like Russia's in Ukraine. Now, imagine something like that were to moderate. If you were to say, for instance, there was some sort of armistice, it seems very hard to think about what that would look like, how it could happen, how it could be negotiated. But let's just assume that gets less bad. What would that mean for the price of oil? I think it would go down. And if the price of oil and gas goes down, which are big components of the inflation rate, then inflation probably goes down. And if inflation is going down, then why would central banks raise interest rates into a slowing economy? So you can start seeing that one or two pretty positive things can happen, although we can't forecast why they would happen, that would lead to material changes in monetary and fiscal policy. And actually, with markets already down circa 20%, bonds down, you know, some UK bonds are down 40% year to date, you can see just some sort of rally or even a moderation of what has been quite a tricky 2022.
I know we were discussing the Bank of America Merrill Lynch survey where they were talking about cash being at a 21-year high and then referring to the S&P being almost near a 200-day moving average and signalling that, I guess, ultimately, are we entering territory of a Santa rally?
Well, it does feel like that. It feels like all the bearish news is very well established. I think social media helps with that these days. You know, the minute there's a bad indicator, everybody knows about it. Everyone's panicking about it. If you talk to your friends in your own home life, they are talking about scaling things back. Now, that can have in itself an unintended consequence of causing the slowdown. We need to get some sort of optimism coming back again. But I think it's right. You know, when you look at how investors are positioned, cash levels at 6.1%, I think the Bank of America Merrill Lynch index said, are as high now as they were back in 2001. You know, we're not in that type of environment. So it seems like investors are very bearish. The forecasts are not great, but they're not super bearish. So yeah, feels like there could be some sort of rally towards the end, particularly if the earnings season in the States. We've seen some good numbers coming out of some of the US banks. Banks tend to be able to make money in all parts of the economy. So if the banks are having a tough time, it's normally an indicator that the entire economy is having a tough time, and that's not really coming through yet.
I want to end on a positive outlook, so maybe I'll go with the negative stunt. What could we see from this point more negatively? If earnings started to come through more pessimistically, we started to see indications of a harder and deeper recession, what could that mean for markets?
Yeah, well, I mean, if we were to say, looking back over at previous bear markets in the equity market, that would be minus 35, minus 40 for developed markets. So that means we're only halfway through it. It means another painful year in 2024. In bond market space, if it's a slowdown and no inflation, bonds actually have a decent rally. So the diversification benefits of bonds come back into play. But I think you've got to be pretty bearish for those sort of things to happen. You'd need an escalation of Ukraine rather than anything easing. You'd need there to be perhaps a credit issue in China. The moment they seem on top of it, it's very hard to get data out of China. I mean, people are talking about trillions of new credit having been created to try and smooth things. It seems like a lopsided economy, and it's the second largest economy in the world. That'd be tricky. And then the one thing that normally happens in some sort of crisis of the last two decades is we start worrying about financial security and stability in Europe. And actually, that hasn't arisen this time, even though they've got a war on their doorstep. So maybe that's a good signal that actually something like Europe is not the problem this year.
I know we always say we should see a sell-off or a correction as an opportunity. And I know some of the European managers we've been speaking to are quite enthused about the opportunities that they are seeing. We focused today really on probably the UK and the US to a large degree. Looking more broadly, are there other pockets of hope in the world, maybe even emerging markets outside of China?
Yeah, I think more broadly speaking, the strength of the dollar this year has made virtually every other asset look very, very cheap. So the US stock market has benefited from the fact that US companies earn money in dollars, the dollar has been rising, therefore the value of those dollars in euros for a European portfolio manager or for a UK portfolio manager or Japan portfolio manager means everyone's been flooding into the US. So if there's a moderation of current trends, you'd expect that to reverse. And actually you might see the really fantastic names in the States, the Googles, the Netflix, the Amazon, they could continue the underperformance that you'd seen recently. Because people start becoming more balanced in their approach. Europe, I think, looks a really interesting area from an earnings point of view, but that does presuppose that Ukraine really doesn't get any worse. China has just had areas of Shanghai locked down again. This COVID policy that they've got really is constraining their ability for economic growth. I think, you know, one of the economies we haven't spoken about is Japan, where the continued weakness of the yen is going to become a real competitive strength for Japanese exporters at some point. We've got to look to see if there is something there. And then, of course, Latin America and emerging markets more general. We always talk about emerging markets as some amorphous block. They're very different. The importers of energy will have had a tough year this year. The actual exporters of energy, like Brazil's not had a great time, but it's got oil. And actually, you look at the monetary policy in Brazil, it looks like it's super tight, positive real interest rates. That means if you go and buy a bond in Brazil, you could get a decent return. So I think you're going to have to be very selective in emerging markets, but there are some good opportunities there. Basically, anything outside of the dollar zone looks like it could be very interesting.
Marcus, I think we'll leave it there for today. Thank you for your time.
Investment involves risk. The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back any of the amount originally invested. Because of this, an investor is not certain to make a profit on an investment and may lose money. Exchange rates may cause the value of overseas investments to rise or fall. This communication is for information purposes only. Quilter Investors uses all reasonable skill and care in compiling the information in this communication and in ensuring its accuracy, but no assurances or warranties are given. You should not rely on the information in this communication in making investment decisions. Nothing in this communication constitutes advice or personal recommendation. Any opinions expressed in this document are subject to change without notice and may differ or be contrary to opinions expressed by other business areas or companies within the same group as Quilter Investors as a result of using different assumptions and criteria. Data from third parties be included in this communication, and those third parties do not accept any liability for errors and omissions. Therefore, you should make sure you understand certain important information, which can be found at www.quilter.com/third-party-data. Where this communication contains third-party data, Quilter Investors cannot guarantee the accuracy, reliability, or completeness of such third-party data and accepts no responsibility or liability whatsoever in respect of such third-party data. This podcast is suitable for professional clients in the UK and UAE and for accredited and institutional investors in Singapore. Investment involves risk. The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back any of the amount originally invested. Because of this, an investor is not certain to make a profit on an investment and may lose money. Exchange rate changes may cause the value of overseas investments to rise or fall. This communication is for information purposes only. Quilter Investors uses all reasonable skill and care in compiling the information in this communication and in ensuring its accuracy, but no assurances or warranties are given. You should not rely on the information in this communication in making investment decisions. Nothing in this communication constitutes advice or personal recommendation. Any opinions expressed in this document are subject to change without notice and may differ or be contrary to opinions expressed by other business areas or companies within the same group as Quilter Investors as a result of using different assumptions and criteria. Data from third parties may be included in this communication, and those third parties do not accept any liability for errors and omissions. Therefore, you should make sure you understand certain important information, which can be found at www.quilter.com/third-party-data. Where this communication contains third-party data, Quilter Investors cannot guarantee the accuracy, reliability, or completeness of such third-party data, and accepts no responsibility or liability whatsoever in respect of such third-party data.